Well, the war in Gaza rages on today, deadly and terrifying to the families who live there. Such a disappointment to many who had hopes for peace under the current Israeli and Palestinian leaderships. Certainly a failure for President Bush, who had made Israeli-Palestinian peace an explicit goal by the time he leaves office. We will have one of our recurring dialogues now between two regular guests who definitely come from different perspectives, but who have done some creative common ground seeking here in the past. David Makovsky, former editor at the Jerusalem Post, now a senior fellow at the Washington Institute and director of their project on the Middle East peace process. And we are trying to hook up our phone line to Lebanon, where Rami Khoury is. He's the director of the Faris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut and editor-at-large of the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut. We hope to get Rami Khoury up here in just a minute. Oh, David Makovsky, his line dropped off. We'll have him in just a second. People have started to post, by the way, for the conversation that we'll have to finish the show later this hour. If 2008 was a fable, what's the moral of the story? So the first one from Luke in Manhattan is, don't believe the hype. The second one from Petra says, you win some, you lose some. Kate writes, don't live beyond your means. Cynthia writes, the bigger the bubble, the more it's likely to burst. So add to those guys, if 2008 was a fable, what's the moral of the story? Post your answers now to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll take some on the phones later in the hour. Now I think we have David Makovsky. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian. Sorry about that.
That's okay. And we're waiting for our phone line to connect to Rami Khoury in the Middle East. David, I didn't see it, but I gather you said on the PBS NewsHour last night that this war should not be seen in the narrow context of Israel versus Hamas, but in a broader light with multiple players. Is that right?
That's correct. I think it's a big mistake to look at it as Israel versus Hamas. The real story here is, but I think on one side is Israel, the Palestinian Authority on the West Bank, Egypt, and even Saudi Arabia, and Hamas is on the other side. And in that sense, it's a replay of 2006, when those sides both all saw Hezbollah in that case, Hamas in this case, as a proxy for Iran, and therefore would like to see Hamas now suffer a setback. So the regimes and their publics are not necessarily on the same page. But of course, there's a chance of diminishing returns given the unpredictability of warfare that things could change. But right now, I think we're seeing a very similar lineup that we saw at the start of 2006.
So it's sort of, as you see it, Hezbollah, Hamas, and Iran versus Israel, the Palestinian Authority, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia.
Right. I would add Jordan, too, to that.
Jordan, an ally at this point of
right.
the United States,
right.
pretty much, and with a pretty stable peace agreement with Israel.
Right.
What
right.
role do you see Jordan and Saudi Arabia playing in this? If you're putting them on a side, are
right.
they actively doing anything to undermine Hamas or support Israel?
Well, I think that, you know, in the Middle East, everything is nuanced. So, if you get an Arab diplomat on the air, he might say, I don't like an invasion or something like that. But let's say Mubarak, he was forced to say he didn't like it. But at the same time, he says, I'm not going to open the crossing points at Rafah. That's the Egyptian-Gaza border. And therefore, there's been a lot of protests of the Arab publics against Egyptian embassies. But what? So on one hand, it's the opening and closing of that area. But look at Arab forums, the Arab League. Are they going to? You know, the Saudis are trying to put off a summit, saying, "Well, nothing will come out of it." And at the foreign ministers' meeting, they seem not to even agree on a resolution. So what you see is real division. The way it's played out often in the Arab world is it's not always by what is said; it's by what is not said. And by what is not said here is there's no. We all stand behind Hamas. Now, it's always complex in the Arab world because, you know, you have Arab satellite TV showing pictures of human suffering, which I think, you know, tugs at the hearts of everyone. And it should talk, you know, there's a suffering on both sides, on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli side. But the leaders see Hamas as a proxy for Iran, and they would like, I think, Israel to you know, make sure they suffer a blow. But when I say diminishing returns, there's always a fear, well, what if an Israeli rocket hits a school or something and kills innocent people and then makes the pictures so overwhelming that it puts these leaders who are not elected, I should point out, into a box. And I saw Ehud Barak seemed, according to reports this morning, he kind of wanted to take up this French proposal for a pause because I think he feels it's good to end on a high note. But that view was not accepted, and it came after Hamas hit Beersheba for the first time. It's like 30 miles away. So, you know, these things are very hard to calibrate, but it's clear that the 2006 dilemmas that were faced with the Hezbollah war, we're seeing a lot of this being replayed. I mean, in some ways, it's very fascinating to see the similarities.
So is this a new alignment now that seems relatively long-lasting from the 2006 Hezbollah-Israel war across the Lebanon border, that there's this new alignment in the Middle East, and it's kind of more, I don't know if even is the right word, but it used to be Israel against everybody. Now it's more complicated than that, right, and kind of lining up like that for the foreseeable future?
You know, I want to be very careful here. I don't want to overstate, and I think it's careful. It's not like the Saudis, the Egyptians, and, you know, were giving Israel weapons or sending soldiers or anything like that. And now it's the Arabs. There's solidarity. They cannot do anything like that. But, you know, I think if you, in the big picture, I think most Arab regimes, and I travel out to the Arab world and meet senior Arab officials as I meet senior Israelis, you know, and I could relay a conversation I had with Tony Blair, who I thought said it very well, the former Prime Minister of Great Britain. He said, you cannot talk to an Arab leader today that within 10 minutes of any conversation you begin with them, you're not talking about Iran. And that's their big fear, that if Iran, it's a combination of nuclear weapons, which they're trying to gain, and, you know, their ideological fervor as an Islamist state, that they could, you know, flex their muscles in a way that these Arab countries believe will be at their expense, that Iran is the rising power in the region. Of course, Israel has reason to fear Iran because its president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, has called for wiping Israel off the face of the map, and now is developing the nuclear weapons. So, you know, there is this new alignment, but the problem of a new alignment is that it's not fully formed. It doesn't mean that there's military, you know, alliances and the political conflict of Israel and the Arab world still remains with the Palestinians, with it and Syria. So it's like you feel like the old order is gone and the new order has yet to be born, sort of thing.
David Makovsky from the Middle East, the Washington Institute, and director of their project on the Middle East peace process, former editor at the Jerusalem Post. And now we have our line connected finally to Rami Khoury, from the Public Policy and International Affairs Institute, which he directs at the American University in Beirut, as well as columnist and editor-at-large for the Daily Star, the English-language newspaper for the Arab world based in Beirut. Rami, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Glad to be with you, and hello to David.
Hi, Rami. How are you?
David Good. Was just talking about this new alignment that he sees lasting from the 2006 Israel-Lebanon or Israel-Hezbollah war into this, that seems to have Iran in a way at its center as much as Israel, that there's this sort of Hezbollah-Hamas-Iran alliance, and Israel with the Palestinian Authority, with Egypt, with Saudi Arabia, with Jordan, all sort of on the other side. Do you see the international politics of it that way?
Only only at the level of the governments you could put it in that kind of dichotomy. It's in reality, the situation is much more complicated. I think David very accurately gave a perspective from the American mainstream and for the Israeli mainstream, but this is not widely shared around the rest of the world or the Middle East. I think what more complex, but I think a more complete picture, is that the governments clearly fall, come down as he described it, but you have most of the public opinion in this region is very different. Now, the U.S. has to make a choice, which it has often made wrongly, deciding is it going to support leaders who David correctly said are not elected, and most of them don't have strong legitimacy, some do, some don't. Is the U.S. going to work with leaders like the Shah of Iran, like Marcos in the Philippines, or is it going to work with popular opinion and the majorities in these regions? And this is where the problem is, because the mainstream public opinion in the Arab world is very much with Hamas, and mainstream public opinion likes what Iran is doing in terms of defying the West and developing a full nuclear industry. So there is this complex situation where regimes and public opinion in the Arab world are often at loggerheads with each other. And when you have a situation like this is where you get this tremendous tension on the Arab governments, and you see it with Hosni Mubarak, with all the others, where public opinion wants them to help the Palestinians, and the U.S. and Israel and Europe and Arab leaders want to crush Hamas. They want to, like they wanted to crush Hezbollah, and this is not going to work itself out very easily, this situation. I think the answer is simply that, you know, warfare isn't going to solve these problems, neither for the Israelis nor for the Palestinians. What you need is a political process that looks at Israel and the Palestinians as people who have equal rights and should enjoy stability, security, statehood, prosperity, but equally and simultaneously, not sequentially. And this is the challenge of diplomats and statesmen and stateswomen.
Well, from the Israeli perspective, Rami, I think they would say that they left the Gaza Strip. They ended their occupation unilaterally back in 2005. So presumably Israel does not want Gaza back, so it's not a war for recolonization. So what is Israel supposed to do if it's engaging in a peace process with the Palestinian Authority, but Hamas, which was elected to control Gaza, continues to launch these rockets time after time into Israel?
Right. Well, I'll take your points one by one. Israel did withdraw its settlers and its troops from Gaza, but it encircled it, it strangulated it, it kept assassinating people, and the war continued between Hamas and the Israelis. This was not a normal, peaceful situation. There are strong issues between them that have not been resolved, and Israel continued to have a stranglehold on the people of Gaza. You have about 60% of children in Gaza are anemic now, from the UN statistics. And anemia takes 2 or 3 years to develop, to have kids who are anemic and stunted, small for their size. So there's a big series of issues between Israel and the Gaza Strip and Hamas, which I think can be resolved. I don't think this is a situation that cannot be resolved. I think it can be resolved, but it cannot be seen purely as Hamas firing rockets. Israel is not sitting there, you know, putting popcorn in their lap. Israel is surrounding them, controlling them, blockading them, killing them, imprisoning. There's 10,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails. Not one of them has been charged. So let's look at it in this real context. There's a war. Israelis and Palestinians are fighting a war, and the war has to be seen from the perspective of both sides, and both sides need to adhere to a ceasefire if it's going to turn into a peaceful situation.
David, common ground on that context?
Well, look, sometimes Rami and I find common ground, as we've done on some of your past shows. I think this is the problem, is that Israel was not out for a fight. Israel wanted to continue the ceasefire that had just expired, and it was Hamas that fired 200 rockets. I don't know what a country's supposed to do when that happens. And the other element is, where I don't accept Rami's point, is that Israel, by getting out of Gaza and getting out of what they call the Philadelphia corridor between Egypt and Gaza, the southern area, by it didn't control it as Rami suggests. I mean, that's why Israel is suffering, because they had all these rockets that were smuggled in, and including the ones that hit Beersheba this morning, 30 miles away, and hundreds of thousands of Israelis are now within that rocket fire. One, it decided to get out of all of Gaza, and that meant it lost control. That's the point. You could blame the Egyptians, but I don't think you could blame the Israelis, because they did not control that area.
David, about the control that Rami was discussing over the borders, not allowing food in, the anemia statistic that he mentioned? The Gazans apparently feel that even after occupation, Israel very much is depreciating the quality of their lives.
Well, look, it's clear that, the Israeli government is putting on their websites, how many trucks are allowed in on a daily basis during the war and before the war. I think they have 100 trucks in today. I don't get into all this. I don't know it. And I want to be clear. Anyone who knows me, Brian, and Rami knows me, knows that I want a solution that gives dignity to both sides. Any solution that doesn't give dignity to both isn't going to work by definition. So, we're all on the same page there. And the Israelis will contest the fact that they haven't let these trucks in, and they'll give you all these truck statistics. But without getting into all that, I think the key is all the Israelis want to know is that they're not going to get blown up. They thought they got out of Gaza, but Gaza hasn't gotten out of them. And the issue is, how do you find a way that gives the Gazans the dignity they deserve, and they deserve it, and Israel the security it deserves, and it deserves it? That's the balancing act. And it was, and the Israelis wanted to continue this ceasefire. So, we'd be in a ceasefire now. We wouldn't be in this crazy war if Hamas would have only taken yes for an answer. And that's the craziness of this whole thing. Peres, Shimon Peres, the Israeli president, Israel is a state president, and he said, Israel's out and doesn't want anything from Gaza. So how do you just make sure that rockets are not being smuggled in, and yet at the same time the people get the food and everything they deserve so that they don't live in terrible conditions?
Rami, want to follow that thread and answer how?
Well, yes. I agree with some or much of what David says. It has to be a situation where people live with equal rights. But the equation, I would challenge him, I would correct him or suggest that it's a different equation. It's not dignity for the Palestinians and security for the Israelis. It's equal security, equal dignity, equal human rights, equal national rights for the Palestinians, for the Israelis. Simultaneously, they are both children of God. They have the same rights under law, under God, under UN Charter, and in each other's eyes. They have to be treated equally. It's security for both people. Hamas didn't fire rockets for 6 months. They wanted to extend the truce. The Israelis didn't like that very much, and they didn't agree. Both sides can be blamed. What I'm saying is both sides have done bad things. What the Israelis are saying is, oh, it's just those Hamas rockets. If they stop firing rockets, everything would be hunky-dory. Well, that's not the case. The UN, if David and I are protagonists and people don't agree with us, go to the UN website. Listen to Karen Obezaid, the head of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, who's in charge of basic needs of the Palestinians. Listen to what the UN diplomats, and these are impartial people who are on the ground, who know the situation. There is a terrible pressure on the Palestinians, which is created by the Israeli stranglehold on Gaza. Now, that could have been resolved through the terms of the ceasefire. So we do have a basic problem in terms of the two sides speaking a different language. The Israelis say they want security. The Palestinians say they want to live in security as well. And it can be achieved, I think, but you need, I think, a more honest attitude coming out of Israel. And the Palestinians have made it, I think, pretty clear that they're prepared to play ball. They did a truce. They're prepared to do another truce. They're prepared for a long-term truce. So there's an opening there. The Israelis, I think, have a big dilemma, which is they cannot solve a political problem with overwhelming military might. They tried it in Lebanon. They tried it in Gaza. They're trying it again, and it won't work. Hamas is going to come out stronger from this, not weaker.
Rami Khoury from the Daily Star in Lebanon and the American University in Beirut. David Makovsky from the Washington Institute, director of their project on the Middle East peace process there. So looking forward, David, it's reported that, and it seems apparent, that Israel is going after military, political, and academic targets and trying to destroy the whole infrastructure of those things. So after the fighting stops, what's left and with what implications for either side?
Look, the question is Israel, for example, going to go on the ground and basically head towards this Gaza-Egypt border and try to explode a lot of these tunnels, which were used to smuggle in the rockets that are now hitting Israeli cities? And if it goes that way...
Why doesn't it just do that? Why does it have to destroy universities?
Well, that I don't know, and the Israelis will say that a lot of the Hamas people are hiding out in these places with their caches of weapons. I don't know. I've seen quotes or something of Hamas officials, I believe, if I saw correctly in the press, that they're largely hiding in mosques with the weapons because they know that Israel doesn't want to hit mosques. So they're counting on that, and they're exploiting it. So, you know, they could be exploiting it in the university, too. I don't know. I'm sure that Israel does not want to hit academics, as maybe was suggested here. But, the question is, if you're going to go to the land and go ahead to the Egyptian-Gaza border on the ground, then you got to think forward, okay, what do you want to do once you've exploded these tunnels? Who's going to take over? Is Israel going to stay there? Or does Israel think that the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank could move in there? Does it think the Turks? The international community came into Lebanon, and according to what been published, Israeli intelligence heads say that there's now triple the number of rockets in the areas than there was before the war of 2006. So international troops won't be the answer. And I think, like I was saying at the start of the program, that, you know, how 2006 war is hovering over this conflict, you know, this question on how does it end is key. I don't see any signs right now of Israel trying to fully reoccupy Gaza. Israeli security officials tell me that could be a year effort. And it's not like the West Bank where you have, like, key roads and all you do is put tanks in and kind of surround the cities. It's urban warfare, and that means a lot of casualties on both sides. It's something Israel's trying to avoid. I may add, for your listeners, I mean, it should be obvious, but Hamas is firing indiscriminately against Israeli towns and cities. Israel is trying to bomb carefully, but there's been collateral damage, and my assumption is they miss sometimes. But I don't think you can make any moral equivalence between the two. Having said all this, I'll just say that I repeat, you know, my belief, you're not going to find military solutions. Ultimately, you want a solution that gives dignity to both sides. But people are not going to have dignity on both sides if people are firing rockets into their cities.
Rami Khoury, do you want to engage the moral equivalency question?
Well, there are different kinds of tactics that both sides are using. Israel is a country, it's a state, it's very powerful, it's got a strong central government, it's got enormous military might. Hamas, on the other side, is a semi-governmental organization now. They fight a guerrilla warfare. They've engaged in the past in terrorism by blowing up pizza parlors and things like that in Tel Aviv. They've actually done very little of that in recent years and changed their tactics. But these are they're apples and oranges. But the point is that Hamas is fighting what it sees as a resistance and liberation war against Israel, and Israel is fighting what it sees as an existential survival war. They're completely different. You can't equate them. I think the answer is that you've got to find a way to get a ceasefire that is implemented by both sides, which means ending the Israeli siege and blockade, letting Palestinians in Gaza live a normal life. And they've said that they're prepared to maintain a ceasefire in Gaza and stop firing at the rockets, but only when Israel stops killing them through malnutrition and starvation and unable to get to hospitals and things like that. So both sides have to have those guarantees. A ceasefire, probably with international intervention, which I think is acceptable to both sides. The trouble for Israel is that is going to be a victory for Hamas in the same way that Hezbollah has emerged much stronger in Lebanon. So in the final analysis, Israel has to do what the U.S. did with the Vietnamese, with the Taliban, with the insurgents in Iraq, what it did with the IRA in Northern Ireland. Talk to these people because they're legitimate.
They use violence, they use terrorism, you don't like them, but they're legitimate. They represent many more people than Abu Mazen. Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, has about as much legitimacy now as the governor of Illinois. Anybody who talks to Abu Mazen is very much wasting his time. Unfortunately, I say this with great sadness as a Palestinian.
But you've got
to deal with the legitimate people, get them to stop fighting with terrorism and violence and rockets, and get the Israelis to stop firing F-16 missiles into Gaza and killing three-year-old kids. That's the solution.
A lot of Israelis would say, Rami, a lot of Israelis would say political legitimacy internally, maybe, but if their ultimate stated goal is to destroy Israel, which is different now than the Palestinian Authority, then why think that you can ever achieve a meaningful permanent peace with them?
Well, you can, I think, because they've actually become much more nuanced about that. If you look at Hamas's statements very carefully, and I'm not supporting Hamas. I'm a Greek Orthodox Christian from Nazareth. I'm not a Hamas person. But if you look at what they've been saying very carefully, they're prepared to have a long-term truce, to stop fighting with Israel. They say if the Palestinian people sign a peace agreement, they're prepared to accept it if it's put to a referendum, which is exactly what the Israelis do, put their agreements to a Knesset vote. So you've got the potential for Israelis and Palestinians both to forge a peace agreement, have it ratified by their people, if it's a decent agreement that both sides can live with, which I think is doable. Hamas has very clearly said that it made deals with Israel, prisoner exchanges, truces. So this old mantra from Israel and the U.S. mainstream that, oh, they just want to destroy Israel, I think that's not quite the same as it used to be 20 and 30 years ago. So I think people need to be much more accurate and nuanced about
that. We have just a minute left, David. You can have the last word and close
it. Look, we could disagree because Khaled Mashal and a lot of the leadership has said this recently. This isn't 20 or 30 years ago. And whenever they talk about throwing something to a referendum, they make it clear that their idea of a referendum is every Palestinian in the world would vote in the way that in Israel, if someone would say every Jew in the world would vote. I mean, these are things that are done to kill it. Hamas might agree to truce, but I don't believe anything coming out suggests they would agree to peace. If they wanted to agree with peace, they can say so, and I think a lot of these issues can be sorted out. Like I said, Israel wanted to renew this ceasefire. It was Hamas that didn't want to do it. It believed that Israel was weak and it would just take all this rocket fire. My answer is to this is to restore a ceasefire, to stop the killing, and to give dignity for both sides. But that involves security.
David Makovsky, director of the Washington Institute's Project on the Middle East Peace Process. Rami Khoury, the director of the Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut and editor-at-large at the Daily Star. Thank you both very, very much. Happy New Year to both of you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up in a minute. More of our end-of-year news quiz. Were you paying attention in 2008? We'll play a great montage of New York voices in the news produced by our WNYC news department, and then we'll take your calls and posts on the question, 2008, what was the moral of this story? Stay with us.